case for argument is Parakay versus Briley. Miss Rage, or Mr. Rage, I don't know what. I don't know the sex of Jamie. J-A-M-I-E. That could be either, couldn't it?
It's
Rage? You want that? Yeah.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, Jamie Rage on behalf of the petitioner and appellant. I'm here to address the issue of the denial of the appellant's right to present witnesses and evidence on self-defense and the denial of his right to have a jury instruction presented regarding self-defense in his murder trial. James Parakay.
This is purely an issue of state law. I don't understand. You know, some, maybe all states require, have this rule. I don't know why they have the rule, but they have this rule that you have to admit the crime before you can raise a defense of self-defense. So he'd have to admit that he stabbed Hudson to death before he could argue self-defense. That's just a state court evidence rule. Yeah. So why do we have anything to do with that?
Your Honor, I don't think it is merely a state court evidence case. The U.S. Constitution, fundamental law that the defendant is entitled to present a claim of self-defense.
I don't think that's true, actually. I don't think the Constitution requires that there be a defense of self-defense.
And the defendant is entitled to present a complete defense. And if you, referring to the analysis in Taylor v. Rithrow.
So are you saying this rule is an unconstitutional rule? The rule that you have to admit the crime or the prima facie crime before you can present a defense of self-defense?
I don't think that you have to admit the actual crime
of
stabbing.
You're not answering my question. Is that an unconstitutional rule that requires the admission before you can?
It would not be an unconstitutional rule, Your Honor, if that were the rule in Illinois, but it's not the rule in Illinois.
Now you've lost me completely. What does that have to do with anything?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are you saying the state court misapplied its own law?
I am.
Well, why is that a habeas corpus issue? Why is that a federal issue? They made a mistake in their rule, in their evidence.
Well, in most circumstances, Your Honor, a violation of state law does not equal a violation of federal constitutional law. The exception.
Why is it here?
The exception is when the violation creates a serious risk of convicting an innocent person. And the state's own example is set forth in
I don't understand you. You would never. You'd only complain about an error of state law if you thought it might affect. It might have been responsible for the conviction, right?
Yes.
So what's special here? The state court may have made a mistake of state law and that may have resulted in the conviction. Why is that a constitutional violation?
Because the defendant was forbidden to present a defense based upon his innocence, which is self-defense.
Because he wouldn't admit that he committed the crime.
He couldn't remember.
Prima facie crime.
I mean, let me try this. Given that evidentiary rulings and jury instructions normally do not present constitutional questions, wasn't he obliged to expressly alert the state courts to the due process aspect of his claim?
We believe that he, as we argued in our briefs, that he did fairly present the issue to the state courts. The state court, that a reasonable jurist under the standard would have recognized the due process issue. The Illinois appellate court and Mr. Parakay both cited to the People v. Everett case And the People versus Everett case at the time had subsequent history before this court in Everett v. Roth, which addressed the issue of the right to a self-defense jury instruction when there's evidence of self-defense.
But the mere fact that one of the Illinois cases that he cited, the Everett case, later ended up in federal court on a constitutional question wouldn't have signaled to the state courts that he was presenting a constitutional argument, would it?
Well, it didn't. In terms of timing, the subsequent history existed when the Illinois Appellate Court and Mr. Perkett cited the People versus Everett in their case. So that existed at the time. Another related issue is the fact that whether or not you agree with the petitioner that he fairly presented the issue below, that argument was waived by the state at the district court level and therefore cannot now be presented as a defense on behalf of the state, and Mr. Perkett should be allowed to present his claims before this court.
Assuming that waiver by the state and district court is a valid waiver, do we then apply Section 2254D, or do we apply Section 2254A with respect to the substantive standard of review?
You would have to apply 2254A, because 2254D is a deferential standard of review based upon the fact that the courts below did address the issue. The courts below in this case did not address the constitutional...
The state courts.
Sorry,
not
yes.
The court below. They're the court over there.
The state courts addressed the constitutional issue. Here, the state court did not
There's no state court judgment on this issue that we ought to defer to.
Correct.
Isn't that giving the petitioner an awful lot of points for the state's trip in the district court?
Well, Your Honor, I'm afraid that...
We're, in effect, going to give that that state judgment a really good scouring simply because, the state goofed in the district court.
Well, that presumes that the state goofed and didn't want the matter heard. The case...
Of course, here they actually got to the merits in the district court, didn't they?
I'm sorry.
The state actually debated the merits with you in the district court.
The merits of which issue, Your Honor?
Of this issue, of the underlying issue.
Yes.
Okay. So here we'll say they not only didn't raise procedural default, they actually joined issue with you on your substantive argument.
That's correct. And
how strong was the self-defense theory, given the minor nature of his own wounds and his own testimony that he didn't take the deceased's threat seriously?
The level of evidence at the state court level of his self-defense was reasonably strong, and certainly strong enough to meet the requirements under Illinois law and under federal law. Stevenson sets forth that even some evidence of self-defense, even if the opposing evidence is overwhelming, is enough to require that it go to the jury. And
what's the theory of self-defense? I can't figure that out.
The facts of the case involve the fight between Mr. Hudson and Mr. Perkett. Mr. Perkett had been threatened earlier in the evening by Mr. Hudson. Mr. Hudson came to Mr. Perkett's trailer and attempted to forcibly enter the trailer. He was trying to open the door. The two were fighting over the door. Mr. Perkett felt a stinging in his side. He thought he'd been stabbed. He jumped out of the door onto Mr. Hudson, knocking them both to the ground. Thought that at that point that he'd broken Hudson's neck because of the force that he had to apply to respond. These are all evidence that was presented to the...
Well, how did Hudson get stabbed then?
Well, it's unclear
stabbed
how
himself?
Hudson got stabbed.
Third person stabbed him?
There's no argument that he died from stab wounds, but the only evidence regarding a stabbing is there was one witness who observed a petitioner with a knife at one point. The petitioner has no recollection of a knife or of the stabbing.
Then I don't understand his theory of self-defense.
Well, the struggle prior...
The self-defense has to involve the knife. That's what killed Hudson.
No, the actual self-defense began when Hudson approached Paquette and it
began, and the knife has to figure in the self-defense.
The knife does not have to figure in the self-defense, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. If you're in a fight with somebody and all of these multiple things are happening and you don't know how you killed that person, but you killed that person in defending yourself, you should still be allowed to raise the issue of self-defense at trial.
No, I don't understand it. I don't understand how a person says, I broke his neck, or I thought I broke his neck, but then it turns out he's stabbed to death. So what's going on here? Did he break his neck and then stab him to death?
Well, there was evidence
that... What did he think he did?
He didn't remember, Your Honor. He thought he'd broken his neck. But there was evidence that Hudson... I'm sorry.
Who stabbed Hudson? Who do you think stabbed Hudson?
I don't... Who do I think stabbed Hudson?
Yes.
I think the evidence, the only evidence before the court showed that the petitioner stabbed Hudson, which makes his argument of self-defense even more important.
Incoherent.
He had no other...
Makes it incoherent. Makes it completely incoherent.
No, if he is in shock...
One thing that obviously didn't happen is that he broke his neck. He stabbed him.
Yes, Your Honor. But he stabbed him in the midst of a struggle while defending himself. And the case, Illinois law, provides that in an instance where there is evidence of a struggle.
This is precisely what this rule is about. You can't say, on the one hand, I didn't stab him, and on the other hand, I stabbed him in self-defense.
Your Honor, he's not saying that he didn't stab him. He's saying that he doesn't remember stabbing him.
And that's am I correct that that's what makes his version of the facts and self-defense and the defense of self-defense not inconsistent?
That's correct.
And therefore, in your view, it doesn't violate the general Illinois rule. Generally, it's inconsistent to say, I didn't kill the guy, but I have the defense of self-defense.
Absolutely.
But your view is, not on these facts, and to deprive the man of the defense on these facts is to deny him due process.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's the ballgame, right?
Thank you. Yes,
right
that
there.
Is it.
Is that correct? Because he did not admit having killed him. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I don't have the trial records.
He admitted having killed him. I think what you're supposed to do in Illinois is you're supposed to admit, I killed him, but I did it in self-defense. He is not admitting that he killed him.
It's not in the record that whether or not he admitted that he killed him. And we do not have the trial record before.
Do you admit that he killed him?
I'm not in a position to
say
I don't have the trial record.
You're not complying with the rule. You're not complying with the Illinois rule. You refuse, even at this stage, to admit that he killed him, and yet you still want a trial on self-defense.
Your Honor, we will admit that he killed him. I believe the evidence shows that he killed him. The paroquet killed Hudson.
Okay,
during
thank
the struggle.
You. Okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reyes. Mr. Feinerman?
May it please the Court, Gary Feinerman from the Office of the Illinois Attorney General. I'm here on behalf of the warden. The Assistant Attorney General, who previously handled this matter, has left the office, so I'm here in her stead. To pick up on Judge Posner's questioning, we agree that what the petitioner's argument here is simply that the Illinois state courts misapplied the Illinois law of self-defense. And what there are five or six elements of self-defense. And one of them, and the one pertinent here, is that the defendant must prove that he actually and reasonably believed that the kind and amount of force that he used was necessary to avert the danger. Now, the kind and amount of force used here was that somebody stabbed the victim several times in the chest. Now, the defendant testified that he wasn't aware that he stabbed the victim several times in the chest, or stabbed him at all, wasn't even aware that he was holding a knife at the time. So it would have been impossible for the defendant to prove at trial that he actually believed that stabbing the victim in the chest was necessary to avert some danger. Now it's the basis for the appellate court.
How do we factor in the fact that he thought he killed him By breaking his neck. In other words...
It's a mystifying explanation, so I'm not sure how that can be factored in. But really, I think this boils down to is that there was no error of state law. The state law is clear that you have to demonstrate an actual belief that the amount of force used was necessary to avert a danger. But even if there was an error, and there wasn't, it's really a question of state law. And you get into the rather fine distinctions drawn by the Illinois cases between what's an accident, can you claim an accident and also claim self-defense, in what situations can you do that, and in what situations can't you?
I mean, it really does put someone like this in between a rock and a hard place. He, you know, presumably is high on something or other. He thinks he broke this fellow's neck. He doesn't even know if he's holding a knife, and yet he has to say, he has to lie to get to his self-defense argument, doesn't he?
Well, we're presuming that he was telling the truth when he said that he wasn't holding a knife, wasn't aware that he was holding a knife, and he wasn't aware that he stabbed the victim.
What did he admit to, though? He thought he broke the guy's neck. Why did he think that?
I think, based upon my reading of the appellate court opinion, it would appear that he thought that the victim broke his neck as part of the fall that occurred after the defendant exited the mobile home, and there was some tussle, and I think...
Tussle between the defendant and the victim?
Yes, the defendant and the victim, that's correct.
So are you suggesting that when he was trying to say it hadn't been deliberate, it had been an accident?
I think that's what his counsel is saying now, that Perruquet argued that it was an accident, but it's not an accident. And before I go on, let me say this is really a matter of state law that's not cognizable on federal habeas. But if we're going to get into the state law, he's not claiming that there was an accident in the way that the Illinois courts mean what they mean by accident in these kinds of cases. In the Everett case, for example, the defendant felt threatened by some men, so he pulled out a gun. And then he said he tripped backwards and bumped into a mailbox, and the gun accidentally went off. And that's the kind of accident where the defendant actually admits to an intentional act, pulling out a gun, and an unintentional result.
He admits to an intentional act, fighting with Hudson.
That's a good point. But it's an intentional act that is so far removed from the actual cause of death. In another Illinois case that's very similar to this Everett case, the defendant felt threatened by two men in front of him, and he swung a knife, and either on his backswing or his follow-through, he claims that he hit a woman who was standing behind him. There's a very tight nexus to the actus reus and the result, albeit unintentional. Here, there's no connection at all between what the defendant said, what the petitioner said that he did, and what actually happened.
What if he had said, I admit using deadly force to do something?
It's a closer case. If he had said deadly force, I had tried to stab him, I had a knife, I tried to get him in the shoulder just to back him off, but I missed, and I got him in the chest.
Well, what if he said... I think what Judge Rovner's question is, what if he said, yes, I was using all possible force, and I don't remember the knife, but obviously I must have stabbed him to death. There's no alternative explanation. If he said all that, he wouldn't have to say that he remembered the knife. To say, yes, obviously I must have stabbed him, although I don't remember it. Wouldn't that be enough?
That situation would fall within the interstices of the Illinois case law.
But isn't that the problem, that he has never admitted that he actually killed, except until 5 minutes ago, he's never actually admitted that he killed?
It's not that he didn't admit to not killing him. It's that he didn't admit to having used force that was wanting to use force that was necessary to avert some danger. His story just doesn't hang together enough to even bring him within the law that's been developed by the Illinois court, let alone present a matter of constitutional dimension that's appropriate for
federal
habeas.
What are the big holes in your view in that?
In
the big hole.
In what?
Not admitting. Because he says, my God, I thought I killed, you know, I thought I broke his neck. I thought I...
The big hole is really a matter of Illinois law. He has to demonstrate that he actually believed, and I'm quoting from the Illinois cases, that the kind and amount of force used was necessary to avert the danger. Here, the kind and amount of force used was stabbing somebody not once, not twice, not three times in the chest, but several times in the chest, and that's just not an accident. That somebody gets stabbed maybe once, maybe the victim had a knife and fell on it, and there you have one stab wound, or got picked up and dropped again, so that's maybe two stab wounds. Here we have several stab wounds in the chest. That's really not an accident. I think that's the whole, is that he didn't even admit that there was a knife involved, or that he was aware of a knife. And if he wasn't aware of a knife, let alone that he stabbed...
Oh, I see. Okay, so wait. So he testified not that he'd had a lapse of memory, but that during the incident he was not aware that a knife was being wielded? Which was it?
I think both. I think that he said that he wasn't aware that he had a knife.
Right. Not that he has forgotten what happened, but he wasn't aware at the time. He has a recollection of not being aware of having a knife.
Right, and he says that he first learned, he thought that the victim had his neck broken. And he said he wasn't aware that a knife was involved until I think the manager of the trailer park told him after the events in question, or maybe a day or two or three later.
That's just preposterous, right?
That's what we say.
No one could think that.
Well, what if you were so high on drugs or alcohol that you don't know what you're doing or remember it later? I mean, that happens all the time.
It would be an hallucination, right? Because he didn't testify that he forgot. He testified that during this fracas, he was not aware of a knife. So the question is, could he have had a hallucination?
I don't think
he
knew
that.
Did
he argue that he was hallucinated? Did he argue that he was drunk? Or?
No, I don't believe so. My reading of the Fourth District's opinion doesn't suggest that the defendant argued that he was so drunk or on drugs, or even that he was drunk at all, that he couldn't possibly have formed an awareness of what was going on.
Is it possible to be in such a rage that you can't recall?
I really don't know. Mm-hmm. Just one point.
I have one point.
Oh.
Before,
I'm sorry.
If you don't mind, because what I'm wondering here is if he did waive the fair presentment argument, then where we are in terms of our standard of review, because if the state court never considered the due process claim, then there would be no state court ruling for us to defer to.
That's the point I was going to get to, and thank you for asking. And may I?
Sure, of course.
There was no waiver. The state did not raise procedural default in the district court because it did not have a reasonable opportunity to do so. If we could take a look at ground three of the petitioner's petition for habeas corpus, what that is essentially a rehash of the state law arguments that the defendant had made in the state courts. Now, in the heading and in the concluding paragraphs, the defendant threw in the word, or at this point, the petitioner threw in the word due process. But as our office read the petition, the petitioner was not really making a due process argument, and we argued that it was non-cognizable. So given that there really was no facial due process argument, it would be it's not even enough to say it wasn't fully developed. It wasn't developed at all. The state was really under no obligation to argue that this this federal claim wasn't fairly presented to the state courts, because in our view there was no federal claim. There really was no facial federal claim.
Did you take note of the fact that the words federal appeared in the petition?
I think the assistant who was handling it would have had to, because the word
did
appear.
Did she in the reply? She had a reply to this thing in the district court. Did she?
Yes.
Did she note that the words federal were used?
Right. And what the argument was that the argument that we made in our answer in the district court was that you just can't slap a federal due process label on what is essentially a state law claim. Now, on appeal, after the petitioner was appointed very able counsel, counsel made a fully developed federal due process argument that actually cited federal due process cases, which didn't happen in the district court. And it was, it's an incorrect argument, and it's a non-cognizable argument, but it was actually there for all to see, and it was a facially a federal due process argument. And at that point, we raised the procedural default, because at that point was the first part that we had a reasonable opportunity.
And sorry, that was when?
On appeal, after counsel was appointed and actually made a facially.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Feinerman. Mr. Rage, your time has expired, but I'll give you a minute if you'd like.
Ms. Rage, is this argument we just heard from the counsel for the government correct? Is that a fair rendition of what appeared in the papers in the district court?
Your Honor, I don't have it in front of me either, and I'm unable to respond to that.
I mean, that's that could be very important as to whether or not somebody is not representing what really happened.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, certainly the district court responded to the federal argument, and I believe it's in the position, but I don't have it in front of me to point you to it. I do want to address the issue of the argument that we might be arguing that the killing was an accident, and we're not arguing that anything that Mr. Parroquet did was an accident. He intentionally came out of the door at Mr. Hudson after believing that he'd been stabbed, and that's when they engaged in this fight. He admitted that he thought that he'd seriously injured Mr. Hudson in the fight. He only would not admit that he had a knife or that he stabbed Hudson. And he said that was because he could not remember having the knife or stabbing Hudson, not because he didn't do it or that there was no knife there, only because he didn't remember.
I thought his testimony was that he wasn't aware of a knife, not that he didn't remember.
Well, he did testify that he did not remember, and I think that it's not mutually exclusive that he wasn't aware that there was a knife, that he didn't remember the knife, and that's how. That's how that testimony actually worked together.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not?
I was, Your Honor.
So we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 Monday morning.